Welcome to Eyewit Health. I'm Jeremy Quinby. This is episode 104 of the podcast. If you're a new listener, I want to welcome you. Eyewit Health is your place for trusted health guidance and resource. Whether you're looking to improve your health or just seeking ways to stay well, we're here for you. This growing community is on a mission to improve our state of being and experience together on the planet. And if you love the thoughtful and informative content you get here, maybe it's time to consider becoming a health amplifier. You can support this community over at patreon.com/highwaytohealth. And every dollar that you give goes towards the development of resource toward a more integrative approach to care. Thanks for all your support. My guest for today's show is Dr. Cecily Havert, and she's here to talk with me about treating vulnerable populations and the physical and emotional and mental health challenges that we find with them. While we get into the specific challenges of the LGBTQ community, I think it's important to consider the lack of attention of care and relationship building in many situations missing in how we treat women, Black Americans, Latinx, and a number of ethnic minorities in this country. Some very important considerations for us all here as we consider building a care team for ourselves and how these relationships are critical to our health and sense of well-being. Here's my conversation with Dr. Cecily Havert. I tried doing a little bit of research on you. I didn't find a whole lot out there. Where are you right now with your practice?
I mean, we're in terms of location?
Location, yeah.
Yeah, location. So I'm in the Washington, D.C. area, okay. But I practice just outside D.C. in Alexandria, Virginia.
Okay, yeah, my aunt's out in Reston, so I know it pretty well.
Okay, yeah, a little bit further out. Yep. Yeah.
And so... We're going to get into talking about the very specific work that you've gotten into, but where did you start as far as medicine and treating people is concerned?
So I did my medical school training in Milwaukee, actually.
Oh, you
so
did?
I went to
okay.
Medical college. I'm actually from the Midwest. I grew up in Minnesota.
I'm in Minneapolis.
You're in Minneapolis right now?
Yes, this is where this
you
is.
You are kidding me.
I also.
Are you born and raised Minnesotan?
I am.
Oh my gosh. Okay. All right. So I was born and raised in Minneapolis. I actually lived near Lake Nokomis.
And I live right by Lake Harriet. So
okay. So we're like neighbors.
We are neighbors.
Yeah. And then when I was in high school, my parents, we moved out to Bloomington. So okay. I went to Thomas Jefferson.
Gotcha. Yep.
I'm a Jefferson Jaguar. And so I was out there. And then I went to Madison. Okay. For my undergrad. And so I was the black sheep of the family because everybody else went to the U of M, including yep. both my parents and my brother.
My son's just about to go, actually.
He's going to Madison?
He's going to the U of M, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So then I went to Madison. I was there for 5 years and then I did medical school in Milwaukee. And so I lived there for 4.
Okay.
And actually I met my husband in Madison. He was a graduate student when I was an undergrad.
Okay.
And then we stayed together through med school and he was a postdoctoral fellow out at NIH at the time that I was looking at residency. So then I ended up just doing my training out here.
Okay.
Did my training in Fairfax and then I just never left. You just kind of start to put down roots.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I've worked at, actually the year after residency, I sort of, instead of just jumping back into being a cog in the wheel of treating patients and everything, I really wanted to take a step back and learn a little bit more. And so I did a self-created fellowship in health policy. I figured since I was living in the DC area. So I went and I reached out and I found a nonprofit organization that does a lot of work in women's health.
Oh, okay.
Basically translating medical information into dialogues and narratives that can be understood a little bit easier, which is kind of what doctors do anyway.
Right exactly.
That's kind of our job is to translate all that complicated information into understandable narrative.
Yeah.
And so, so it was a nonprofit that did that. And then I also did some work in a reproductive health clinic, a women's health clinic. And I did a lot of, it was great just to, work with that population. And then I decided, I'd gotten some, extra interests that I have. Mm-hmm. And then I was able to bring that into my practice what I currently do. And so I've been in private practice this is my, let's say I worked at Springfield Family Medicine, then I moved to General Internal Medicine, and now I'm at Northern Virginia Family Medicine, so private practice.
Okay. And urgent care along the way too, or is mostly just private, primary care?
Urgent care. No, I'm family medicine, so yeah. Trained in family medicine, so I've really... what I really enjoy about that is the relationship and the continuity of care aspect.
Yeah.
And so I've enjoyed that.
Yeah. Me too. I mean, yeah. I'm not a doctor. I started out working as a manual therapist, and then got into doing functional movement work with people. So teaching movement, doing postural correction work, recovery from surgeries and injuries and stuff. Also along the way was starting to practice craniosacral therapy, which is now becoming a much bigger, people are starting to understand how to use it for a lot of different things. And I'm getting a lot more collaborative work with, I do everything, you know, work with dentists and therapists and, you know, just you name it, actually a lot of orthopedic issues and a lot of trauma. And so it's been great work for me. And I was out in New York, actually. I started a center in Brooklyn, New York for, I was there for 13 years, but I've been going back to treat people because I had developed all these relationships, and I started treating newborns about 15 years ago.
Do you do torticollis stuff?
I do torticollis. I do a lot of feeding challenges and, you know, GI stuff and just, you know, birth trauma in general.
It's a traumatic experience for everybody involved, including the one being born.
Right. And I think the parents often forget that, you know, that the baby just went through a tough experience too. But I love it's actually the one point in which I kind of start to work with an entire family. And sometimes there's like a parent, grandparent, caregiver in the process too. So I end up with like multi-generations and families, and I love it. It's like being kind of an old family doctor. I'm doing more preventative and kind of maintenance work with people, but that's part of the reason I continue to go back there is because I have these long relationships.
That's great. That's great. What were you doing out in Brooklyn? Did you do some training out there?
I just got moved to go there. I went in 2000 and I had some good friends there, really liked the sort of neighborhoody feel. I was kind of missing that a little bit in Minneapolis at the time. And I was totally drawn to it. I never really wanted to live in Manhattan. Just it was Brooklyn that I kind of got.
It was Brooklyn, yeah.
So I, that's. That, like,
yeah, I was going to say, but you're like the typical Minnesotan. You left and you came back. Everybody does. I'm like, you know, everybody's like
a sea turtle or something. Yes.
I don't know what it is. I don't know. Like I left in, when did I leave? In 97, I guess was when I, last time I lived in Minnesota. So yeah. In a while.
Yeah, so it makes sense. I mean, I can kind of see now the transition of your work, and women's health issues are still, you know, one of those things that are not getting enough attention. So I assume that's been a big part of your career then.
It has been. I think that what I've realized is that I really enjoy working with vulnerable populations and people. Populations, communities that don't necessarily, either there's a disparity in care or they don't have a voice, either that they don't feel that they have one or they haven't been given one, whatever that case is. And I think that's what's drawn me to that. So So the women's health, I mean, I still treat the whole family. I still treat, you know, kids, do geriatrics, but I think that I really, really enjoy working, kind of reproductive age women and actually adolescents. Adolescents are a lot, they're challenging, but they're a lot of fun. And I think there's so much that you can do and offer and just that extra support and just being a safe place for them to realize that. Cause a lot of times there's not a whole lot of safe places for them.
So. Agreed. It's something I've gotten to do a lot more of, especially this last year for some reason. A lot of kind of tween to early teen time. There's a lot of stuff going on with stress and anxiety and just kind of growing into their bodies and even sort of, you know, identity issues around that too.
Completely. I completely agree. And just offering that safe space and, you know, and I think also what I find, very, I guess I'm just honored that, you know, when people feel safe and they feel that they can refer their friends or their other family members.
Yeah.
So the community has, you know, sort of grown also by word of mouth. And so that's important too.
Yeah. So is this kind of what led you into doing more work with the challenges that are going on with the LGBTQ population?
I think so. so. I think it's a sort of a you know, kind of a natural progression, just again, just the vulnerable populations and just finding that, you know, when I worked, it's not like I necessarily sought it out, you know, yeah. You just work and then you have members of the community, seek you for medical care,
yeah.
You know, and then you develop, you know, a relationship with them, and then you sort of realize, and they're so thankful,
yeah,
that you're like, wow, you're the first person that's asked me that, or you're the first person that I felt that I could tell, and it's just, you know, and so then I really was like, wow, that's really important to, you know, to be that person, and you know, there probably should be more of us, and so that to me, it sort of became a calling and a reason. And it's not to say I don't only work with the LGBTQ community, and you know, I have a lot of men, you know, cis males, you know, in my you know, practice too. I'd say actually the majority of them are. But it is nice also to be able to offer a little something different to different communities.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. It's the one thing. It's same with me. I mean, and I do a lot of coordinating work with therapists, and I have a specific therapist that I do a lot of work with that community. And a lot of it just comes down to you being, you know, and this is the way I treat in general, is that I want to understand this person's whole experience. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'm going to work with them, if I'm going to work with whatever challenges they are, because my work is this very crossover between, a lot of times I'm seeing people for both chronic pain issues, but also something that's, you know, more along the lines of anxiety and depression. And so, and that crossroads is where a lot of these, you know, other medical conditions start to flare up, eczema and, you know, histamine issues and food sensitivities, and all these things are at this kind of crossroads of that, you know, sympathetic fight or flight response.
Absolutely. That they've been, stress is a major contributor to, you know, to illness and just, you know, mental health and physical health. It's really,
So what has been your focus then? Is there anything like really specific that you like to treat, or that you, populations you like to work with, conditions you like to work with?
Well, I do work. I mean, I think just the path that I've led down, the populations that I enjoy working with, and that I work with a lot, I do a lot of mental health. I think that it sort of led me. It's just because the mental health care needs tend to be higher.
Yeah.
In these communities. So yeah. I have incorporated a lot of mental health work. It's been great. I'm just living in this area for so long. I've been able to connect with a lot of therapists, psychiatrists, you know, just a lot of different resources. And we're really lucky in the DC area to have access to a lot of good resources. That being said, it's still hard to access them. Right. Whether it's, you know, and especially during this last year with COVID and, you know, mental health, I mean, it's so hard to find a good therapist, and then also be able to afford a therapist.
Yeah.
Sadly, that's a limitation for a lot of people. So, and also with primary care, we're sort of the entry point for mental health too. And I've sort of, you know, recognized that, and again, providing a safe place for people to talk about these issues. And so I do a lot of, you know, entry level, people come to me, anxiety, depression, just, you know, just pretty much anything you could think of. And I work to try to get them into a good stable, you know, therapist, if that's what we need, or whatever, you know, support they need.
Yeah. So in relation to the LGBTQ community, what are the biggest challenges that you see in terms of access to care, or in terms of the challenges they have health-wise?
So I think one of the big issues with access is just fear to actually seek care.
Okay.
Fear of homophobia, not knowing that the, you know, the doctor's office or the doctor or provider that they're walking into is open, is affirming. You know, it's scary. That's, you know, they live that fear and that vulnerability in a lot of different areas of their life. Yeah. But I think going and seeing the doctor is it's even a more heightened vulnerable experience.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's scary. So I think that just seeking the care, I think is an issue. And then this community unfortunately does have, and I think I've alluded to this already, do have a lot of mental health issues.
Yeah.
It's complex. And so that's something that I find that I'm treating quite a bit.
And how do you address something like that when you sense that, you know, someone coming in, are they able to express that to you, or is it something that you have to kind of help them understand what's going on?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, so, you know, and so a lot of times, I mean, I think it is just asking the right questions, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's something that primary care doctors either don't have time to do, or maybe they don't want to incorporate that. They're afraid of, you know, some of the answers, or even if they do ask those questions, what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
You know, where do you have the resources to even, you know, to offer the care that they need? So, you know, I do, you know, safety assessments. That's something that's really, really important.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, and it's not, you know, it's pretty much for anybody who comes into the office.
Yeah.
You feel safe at home, just trying to screen for, you know, something that might be amiss. And also just, it also gives them the, you know, the invitation that this is somebody that I can talk to. This is a safe place. I can talk about these things. I think it's also important to, you know, especially with working with adolescents or anybody, is to confidentiality. Mm-hmm. is also something to be very upfront about and mentioning that this is a conversation between you and I. So, and a lot of times just making sure that once you introduce that or know that that's the format of which we're working, a lot of times people do relax a little bit in because they just, are you going to tell my mom you know, or are you going to call my partner or whatever the situation is.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's so that's helpful in bringing up conversations.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of it is just asking the right questions. And we do have regular screening that we use, you know, the PHQ-9 for, this is not at every visit, but at the, you know, at physicals, or if I get a sense that something's, you know, not right, then we'll just do an assessment.
Yeah.
And so that's helpful. And sometimes people come in and they don't necessarily even recognize that what they're experiencing is anxiety or depression. I mean, you
probably run into that
a lot too. You know, the infamous, you know, the somatic complaints. You know, when the body is screaming, there's something wrong. But when you're not listening to your brain, so then the body starts to get, you know, pain involved or whatever situation or whatever it is.
I see so much of it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, the nice thing with I usually have somebody who's pre-screened, you know, so in a way it's either another doctor that I'm working with or a therapist that I'm working with who identifies a lot of the physical stuff going on, and they've already probably identified some other stuff going on, or they wouldn't be working with this other, you know, doctor or therapist. So it's a little easier for me, but even so, I think sometimes it needs to be reiterated because I think people don't realize how much that emotional experience gets stuck in the body and just in the way that it works in the first place, and responds. You know, so if it's become a system, and this is like a very important thing for people to understand, is that the nervous system loves to work in these patterns, and so it becomes sort of programmed as a response in the system. And then, you know, that is part of what this pain response is. So it's grown over time in response, right? And that it kind of has to leave in the same kind of way. It's not anything that's going to be a quick fix. And for that reason, I'm sure that's, you know, when it gets very extreme is when we need to use a medication or we need psychiatric sort of, you know, some input that way. But there still needs to be these other parts to kind of help balance that. So you have kind of a team of people that you've been working with these kinds of things?
I do. I mean,
or referrers?
Yes. Yeah. It depends on what it is. You know, it's, you know, I think, you know, just speaking of somatic complaints or, you know, physical complaints that go along with anxiety, for instance, irritable bowel syndrome. I don't know if that's anything that you work with, but they say, you know, it's we're finding now that the gut is, you know, considered our second brain.
Yeah. I just did a podcast on it, so it'll be
really? Yeah.
Good preview.
I mean, it really is. Yeah, no. And it's just, you know, the amount of serotonin, you know, the serotonin receptors in the gut are, you know, there's probably more serotonin receptors in the gut than there are in the brain. So So that's something. And so there's a therapist that I work with that actually uses hypnosis to help manage IBS, which has been, you know, fantastic. I think that it's, and everybody, you know, you really have to figure out what headspace the patient or the client is in also, and what they're going to be open to.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to work towards getting to this. It's not, you know, usually hypnosis for IBS is not the first thing that I'll mention, but it is, but you know, some people are more open to it than others. And honestly, there's been, you know, we've had some pretty good results from using it.
Yeah. And so for, I know that there's also a challenge for people who are taking gender affirming hormones as well. So can you talk about that? There are some health related things that maybe they're not aware of, or even a lot of the medical community may not know about.
Yeah. So especially for trans women who are taking gender affirming estrogen in order to, develop a more, you know, feminine appearance, that the estrogen can actually increase risk for breast cancer is probably one of the biggest things that most, so men, cis male, that they don't, you know, there is still risk for breast cancer in men. However, it is not quite as much as women. And a lot of it is driven by the estrogen.
Okay.
So that's something to also pay attention to. So, you know, it's just understanding the screening tests and knowing what tests to order. I think it's important in part of the interviewing process that I do with patients. And also it helps create an affirming safe space is to ask questions that, what was the sex that you were assigned at birth?
Okay.
And, currently what is your gender? What is, you know, so it just sort of understanding, because if you were born, assigned female at birth, you will have, you know, female anatomy that we do still have to be aware of.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there are trans men that I have to screen for cervical cancer. So it's just being aware of that. And so understanding it gets a little bit complicated. And that's why being open and having these discussions is important.
Yeah.
And, you know, the LGBTQ community, especially women, lesbian women, tend not to come in for a lot of their healthcare screening. And so that what I mentioned, the cervical cancer screening tends not to get done. The breast cancer screening tends not to get done. And so we actually do see some higher rates of cancer in women. And it's not because, we don't think it's necessarily because of their, you know, their sexual orientation. It's more the fact that they're just not getting the healthcare and the screening that they should in a timely manner.
And do you think that's because of how they think they'll be perceived in getting care?
Potentially. Again, I think it's complicated to know, but I had mentioned before, just even the access and feeling safe is something. And also, I think there's also a misconception that, that because you're, you're a gay woman, that you're not going to get cervical cancer, you're not going to get HPV, but that it can still happen. And so some of it just might be disregarding that this is an important test, but the guidelines are, no matter you know what your sexual orientation is, you know, who your partners are, we still do want to screen for HPV. There's no change in the recommendations if you're gay or if you're straight.
Yeah. And as I've been wondering about this too, because I see it a little bit in my practice now that I've been working with some of these kind of tween to the young teenagers, is this, that, and I'm sure this happens at older ages as well, when people are kind of starting to question, you know, what their orientation is or how they identify, and they're going to try on some different things for themselves to kind of figure that out. And so, you know, some parents are really good about this. You know, if it's a boy who wants to wear a fingernail polish, or a girl who wants to cut all her hair off or something. But is there anything that you know can tell us about your experience with that, and the way that you kind of talk to parents about this situation, or even just talking to adolescents about it?
Yeah, I think just it's a complicated situation, because there can be a lot of family dynamics at play.
For sure.
And so yeah, you know, but I think that we also know that that parents that do support their children and adolescents and teenagers, you know, especially if they're questioning, if you, the more support you get from family, the less depression, the suicide rate is much lower. There's, yeah, there's a lot of just amazing benefits. So something that I really try to strive for is to try to encourage parents, if they're open enough to it, just to, you know, trust in the process and really just try to support their child,
yeah, yeah,
through this.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's there can be difficult conversations. It's not that this is going to be easy, but I have to say that more and more parents I'm finding are, at least maybe it's in you know, the population that I'm working with, they there's a lot of acceptance,
yeah,
and a lot of openness and a lot of wanting to support their children, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
But I also see a lot more children and adolescents questioning,
yeah,
and coming out and just, you know, maybe trying on a different gender, or, you know, it's just, and I think it's a time for exploration. I think it's such a normal.
That's the way I address it too, is that this,
yeah,
you know, there will be a process here, no matter what, mm-hmm, you know, they decide to do with their lives. This
absolutely
is just one, this is, yeah, just one piece of that. And so, and I have a 10-year-old daughter who's, you know, I've just been having some conversations with about it, who's, yeah, asking me questions about it. And so, and I think partly because, you know, you have a month devoted to it and people are starting to talk about it a little bit more. And so she has a lot of questions and, you know, I just try to be present and, you know, talk about my experiences and, you know, also that, I think we all kind of exist on a certain spectrum that, mm-hmm, culturally we're not as comfortable accepting, but to me, that's, you know, especially living in big cities where, you know, people who have, you know, come from rural areas who have struggled with these challenges, I've gotten to meet and work with a, yes, lot of these people. So
again, it's very different. Like I was saying, I work outside of DC. And so a lot of the, you know, a lot of people I'm working with are probably, you know, a little bit more used to these ideas.
Yeah.
They've been exposed to that. It's something that, you know, but it can be very different depending on the community that you're coming from. And that's, you know, that can be a very, very challenging situation.
Yeah. Do you have any suggestions for anyone who is LGBTQ and may, you know, be feeling like they haven't been getting care? They, you know, depends on what their age is, that they may feel like they have some health challenges or they didn't do certain screenings that they should, where to kind of, you know, first steps for them?
I think, you know, first is, you know, looking, do they have a primary care doctor? Do they have somebody that they usually go to? And if they feel comfortable and safe,
yeah,
going and, you know, maybe asking, you know, just scheduling that physical that they haven't had in,
right,
six,
right,
years or whatever it is, you know, just taking the first step and just saying, yeah, I didn't realize that there could be screening tests, there's things that I might be missing. So just recognizing that. But then, you know, the issue is that either you don't have a primary doctor or the one that you're seeing, you don't necessarily feel comfortable. So it's a process, because I think it is so important to work with somebody that you feel safe with, that you feel that you can talk to.
Yeah.
And whether it is talking to other friends in the community about doctors and or providers that they see that they like, that are open. I think that's important. And then, you know, a lot of other, you know, practices are starting to, you know, place the rainbow flag on their website or, you know, even in their waiting room and just,
yeah,
you know, just being able to find, you know, a practice if that, you know, that has that, if that's important to you, and if that's going to help you get the care that you need to have,
yeah,
that safe environment, then I think, you know, you can find it.
Do you know if there are any national, kind of organizations or places that have a health, you know, kind of resource list or anything like that?
You know, I'm not sure if there is. I know that PFLAG, I love that organization. They, a lot of times there is sort of a regional And they'll sometimes they'll list, you know, doctors that, you know, that are, you know, affirming, sometimes also, you know, doctors that do, you know, hormone, affirming therapies. And, you know, so there are a lot of resources through, PFLAG. I mean, sadly, a lot of this is, you know, almost like a word of mouth, but kind of like at the underground, where can you find the support that you need? But, you know, we're working to try to make it more mainstream and something that's more included, you know. And I have to say, you know, I went to medical school in, let's see, I started in 98. So 98 to 2002, I don't think I had any instruction about taking care of the LGBTQ community, not a single lecture or anything. Yeah. And so I think that it also has to start at the, you know, the earliest level of training and making sure that vulnerable communities and the LGBTQ community are incorporated. That's, you know, an early education.
Yeah. And I feel like even for parents who have a child who's sort of questioning or, you know, starting to explore, I think that's a great point to just have a therapist, to try to find someone in mental health that they can just, you know, bounce things off of. Because In a way, I this is the way I think about it as a parent, is like I want to be the parent. I don't want to be trying to like manage my children's mental health. Even though I know a lot, I feel like I want that to be a separate relationship and a confidential relationship in many ways. And because as you know, as my kids get older, you know, I'm going to be developing a different kind of relationship with them as adult children too. And I want to make sure that becomes something that wasn't a conflict in those years.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it's always hard. You know, I, you know, being a family medicine doctor, I have kids too. I have two sons, 12 and 14, and I've made a point not to be their doctor because I feel like I'm their mother first. Right. And you've got that emotional, my reaction to anything that's going on with them first is emotional. It's not necessarily the clinical, which is the way I approach, you know, other patients that are a little bit, you know, that are not my children.
Yep.
So it's important just to find that support community, and don't it doesn't have to all be on your shoulders. I mean, you're an important part of that support community, but you don't have to do it all.
Yeah. One thing I found here, I do some specific work with a sex therapist who does a lot of work with this community. And I think part of the reason is because they've probably identified the fact that if this person's comfortable talking about anything about sex, they're probably comfortable talking about anything that this that may be coming up in terms of sexual health or even relationship challenges. So that can be one of those. I mean, I'm just trying to kind of think about any ways to help lead people to some resource when they're struggling with this stuff too.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully you're going to have a doctor that, you know, that will ask, you know, the right questions as well and do the right screening tests. I mean, getting a physical is really important. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times, you know, you don't think a whole lot is done at a physical, but honestly, there is so much screening, or it should be a whole lot of screening that happens. I mean, not only, you know, we talked about the mental health part, but also substance abuse. And I don't think we've touched on this a whole lot either, but the substance abuse is also something that we see a lot more of in the LGBTQ community. And so you're doing screening for that. But usually there's so many layers with the substance abuse. A lot of times can be a kind of a coping mechanism you know, a self treatment for underlying anxiety and depression. Yeah. And it just
almost always.
So there's a lot. And the other thing I'd say is, you know, just be honest. Honest. I mean, you're not gonna, you know, it's hard, you know, if you aren't gonna be honest with your doctor about, you know, how much you're drinking, or I mean, it also, you know, but you also have to ask the right questions. That, you know, I can ask a patient how much they're drinking, but then a follow up question will be like, well, have you ever thought that might be too much, or have you ever thought that, you know, have your friends thought that, you know, that there might be a problem? So asking things in that way sometimes helps you think about it in a little bit different way.
Yeah. And as patients, one of the things I always suggest to people who are seeking a new kind of provider. So this is kind of across the board is, you know, if you're trying to find someone who you feel that you want to make sure that they're comfortable with LGBTQ issues, you interview your medical people. Ask them the direct question that you want to know about, both in terms of what is their expertise in treating, you know, what mm-hmm. you have or working with with your population, whatever that might be.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, you have to become an advocate for yourself somewhat when you're trying to find a doctor, try and find anybody, working with anything.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, I completely agree with that.
Yeah, I feel like it's the one thing that I do. That's part of the reason I'm so picky about who is my whatever it is, if it's an acupuncturist or whatever. I usually come out of the gate with a couple of really strong things because how they respond to those things right away tells me if they can handle a challenge or that kind of stuff. And if they pass that right away, I'm usually sold. So
and you have to be aligned. I mean, this is somebody that you're working with, not working against.
Right. I'm trying to build a team usually, you know, like think about it that way.
Exactly. It's really important to have that, you know, have open communication. I think being able to feel that you can communicate, but again, that you're also aligned on the direction that you're going.
Yeah. Are you doing any kind of speaking? Are you doing any kind of videos? Do you do any social media stuff for your work?
Well, so I've started, we've started a podcast, actually a colleague and I have started one. We haven't dropped any episodes yet, but we have probably about 8 or 9 of them recorded and they're being edited.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So that's really, really fun. It's called Living Breathing Medicine. Okay. And it's basically what we're doing is just we're talking with other healthcare providers, other doctors. It's a lot of storytelling on, you know, looking at the human side of medicine and the experience that we've had with patients and
cases.
How we can make. Pardon me?
Like cases that you've worked with or?
It can be cases. We'll start with that. But usually it turns into just what is good medicine and how we can achieve that. And also exploring compassion in medicine a little bit more. So that's where just trying to get down kind of underneath it all. It's but a lot of it's through storytelling, which is really, really fun. I mean, doctors are actually really good storytellers. And if you get a couple of doctors or healthcare providers in a room together, I mean, there could be some pretty amazing, amazing stories and just, you know, but we're trying to explore more compassion in medicine.
Yeah.
So that's something we're doing. I've been doing a little bit more writing, writing a couple of different blogs.
Okay.
We've been, you know, I think I'm interviewed for a couple of different articles. So just, you know, kind of working at getting information out there. I think it's great to be able to reach beyond the exam room for me. You know, just reaching beyond the patients that I see in the exam room. I like to.
Yeah, me too. I mean, that's part of the reason I started this in the first place. I've been very fortunate to have the practice that I have. And I know there are a lot of people who don't have access to, you know, care providers like us.
I know exactly. And so if you can connect somehow, I think that's so great because there's a lot of, you know, great information that I think we can share and also just work to empower people to really you know, be kind to themselves and you find the people and work with people that they deserve.
Yeah, I love it. Well, I'm thankful to be connected to you, and I'll put up links for all the things that you have going on right now too, so people can kind of check in.
Sure, I can send stuff to you as well if you want.
Okay, that's fantastic. And I, you know, part of what I'm doing with this project is also, you know, starting to kind of work on having a guest page for all the people who are on the podcast, so that if people are starting to look for resources or starting to look for resources in parts of the country, that they can find them. So you will be on there and one of my good referrals for out there too. So that's great to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to chat more about anything.
All right, sounds good. Thanks so much for doing this with me.
All right, no problem. Thanks. Great to meet you, Jeremy.
Likewise.
Okay, bye.
Dr. Cecily Havert, folks. What's important at the start of a new patient-care-provider relationship is the sense of safety and the ability to be honest with each other. One thing that too often gets lost in the overwhelm from both sides is seeing the individual sitting right in front of you. We too often project a story that is almost never true. The more true the story is that we get, the better the outcome will be. I'm so impressed with the way Cecily is working with these populations, and it's a model for the way we should be thinking about care, and it's what we should demand as patients. All of us should be receiving care at this level for the monthly premiums we pay. Premium means primary and exceptional. So if you're sitting in an office with a provider who's not listening to you, not curious, not considering your story, find a new provider. There are plenty of great docs out there like Cecily. And be proactive. Don't wait until you have a health challenge to find your care team. Doing this will minimize the stress and anxiety that is inevitable in a crisis. Let me know what you thought of this topic in conversation. You can reach out to me anytime through the contact page of our website, highway2.health. That's highwayto.health. And if you'd like to watch us have this conversation, head over to Highway to Health podcast channel on YouTube. Thanks for listening and for all that you do. Be good to yourself, be kind to each other, and take care of your planet. Be well, my friends.